Hey everyone, welcome to the Pender Podcast. I'm Dave Barr, President and CEO of Pender Fund. Today I'm super excited to be joined by Andrew Wilkinson, a fellow BC native. Andrew is the co-founder and managing partner of Tiny Capital. He founded a tech company called Meta Labs, a Victoria-based design agency in 2006. After rapid growth, he diversified into a variety of businesses, which today form Tiny Capital.
This podcast is for information purposes only. It should not be viewed as investment advice or as an offer to buy or sell Pender's funds. Our funds are not guaranteed, and any discussion of past performance is not an indicator of future results. Any opinions expressed are as of the date of this podcast and are subject to change. Pender may not necessarily share the opinions of our podcast guests. More important information can be found on our website, penderfund.com/disclaimer.
Full disclosure, Pender manages an equity fund that holds a position in WeCommerce.
So welcome, Andrew.
Thanks, Dave. Great to be here. I'm a longtime listener and fan of yours, so it's great to be here.
Oh, it's great. Great to have you on board. And what I find really fascinating is just kind of going through the bio and your career progression. And it reminds me of this great Buffett quote where he says he's a better investor because he's a businessman and a better businessman because he's an investor. And what I find really fascinating, you starting from an entrepreneurial background, starting your own technology companies and the recent evolution you've had becoming an investor and a capital allocator. How has that transition been for you?
Yeah, it's been bizarre. I mean, if you had gone back to 2006 when I first started my original business, MetaLab, and told me that I would be an investor buying businesses and thinking about finance, I think my jaw would have dropped and I would have tried to change the future, because to me, investing in business was a very boring thing that I had no interest in. There's a thread that's run through my whole career, which has just been laziness. I just don't like doing things I don't enjoy. And so, I didn't like having a job, didn't like working for other people. And so I had no choice but to start my own business. And my original goal was that I wanted to just be able to wake up whenever I wanted and work on interesting projects, make enough money. And then I just kind of got ahead of myself. I started delegating work and came up with new business ideas. And then I realized that starting businesses was really hard. So I started buying them. And I realized running businesses was really hard. And I wasn't particularly talented at it once it got to a certain scale. And when I realized I could hire CEOs, I started doing that. And without realizing it, I kind of stumbled my way into investing in entrepreneurship simply by just delegating and being lazy.
That's probably the most authentic self-awareness I've heard.
It's very much the truth. I think there are a lot of investors who are, they love to share stories about how from the moment they were 8 years old, they were, going door to door and buying stocks. I'm not that person. I used to look at the newspaper and skip the business section. And I thought business was this thing that my dad brought home in a briefcase looking sad. I wanted nothing to do with it.
Yeah. I like to say that sports was a business back then, because I just read the sports pages all the time. The numbers were quite fascinating.
Totally.
Your start in the services business and very design centric. I mean, I just think that plays so well into the tech world we're in today. I mean, I've listened to some podcasts where you talk about historically tech companies were started. You'd raise $10 million, you'd buy a whole bunch of stuff, you'd hire a bunch of developers, and the user experience was an afterthought that people kind of tried to figure out 2 months before product launch. How relevant is that in the world today? I mean, from your perspective, how important is design in the technology world?
Well, it's been fascinating. If you think about it, started the business in 2006. In 2006, the iPhone didn't yet exist. There was no such thing as mobile. There was barely even web apps. And so where I specialized was actually in web apps and startups doing that in Silicon Valley. And my timing couldn't have been better because, nobody thought about design. And so it was easy to break into the market. And I specialized in web software specifically. And then when the iPhone came out, I started specializing in mobile software and design. And then I think in about 2010, 2011, Everyone woke up and realized that A, software was eating the world, and now, you know, every company needed to be a software company, but that design was the way that you differentiated and won that. You know, why did Airbnb beat out VRBO? Because of great design. And so when that happened, everybody suddenly really valued the work that we did. You know, we already had a good business, but it went from good to great. It's been really fascinating watching the kind of evolution of design and the respect for design change over the past decade or so.
Yeah, it's so critical today because it's all about the user experience now.
Totally. And we, if you look at our portfolio at Tiny, every business that we own is beautifully designed. The one kind of theme has always been that we look for exceptional products that are beautiful and easy to use. And where we've kind of, you know, found opportunity is taking things that are already working because they have a great product, but then doing a better job of growing and marketing them, which is something that a lot of founders don't really enjoy. A lot of founders love building stuff because they're often designers and developers, at least in tech.
Yeah. So is that like your key inroad when you're acquiring these companies at Tiny? Is it the bringing the business side and letting the people who want to design do the things they want to do?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I think if you talk to any founder in year one, they always say, I want to run this business forever. This is my life's work. Talk to them in year five, they're starting to make good money. They're a little exhausted, but they're still in it. You know, maybe they're slowing down a little bit. And then often by year eight, year 10, they're basically checked out. They're done with it and they want to move on to something new. Most founders don't want to be Mark Zuckerberg. They don't want to, you know, be with a business for 30 years and take it public and stuff. They want to pass the baton to someone else. Sometimes they want to take all their chips off the table. Sometimes they just want a partner to kind of come in and grow it and run the day to day. Before we came along, there was really two doors for these founders. There was venture. And venture is doubling down. Venture is saying, you know, I'm going to grow this from $100 million into a $1 billion business. It's a lot of pressure. I always think of it as a high interest credit card. So it's very expensive and, you know, painful capital to take. On the flip side, there's private equity. And what we observed with private equity by going through this ourselves was that private equity was a bunch of MBAs and Wall Street types who looked at our business like a spreadsheet. We didn't really feel they understood our culture. We were worried they were going to mess up the business. And often they wanted us to keep running it and go into an earnout. And, you know, they'd have pref shares and just all these complex structures. And then we realized that they were just going to go and sell our business in 2 or 3 years and they'd expect us to go along with it. And so we said, you know what? We haven't found anyone. We haven't found the buyer that we want. And so let's just create that buyer ourselves. We've got money now. You know, we had all these profitable businesses and we were building up free cash flow. And so he said, screw it, let's create the third door. We'll create a holding company just like Berkshire, except focused on private tech businesses. And we've been doing that now for 7 years and we're up to over 30 of them. So it's been really a great ride. And it's been born out of our own pain and frustration.
Yeah. I mean, I love following you on social media. I think you just have a wonderful presence and you really articulate the value to potential portfolio companies. Do a lot of companies reach out to you through your social media channel? And by the way, I'd encourage all our listeners to follow you if they aren't already. I'm sure most of them already are.
Oh, thanks, Dave. I mean, it's been funny. I mean, we've been in business for over 15 years. The first 14 were incredibly quiet. I didn't really post on Twitter. I didn't really do podcast interviews. And then during COVID, I started, just because I was bored and I wanted social connection, I started doing podcast interviews. And, you know, we already had a good amount of deal flow coming to us organically. We've never done outbound. It's always just been, you know, through our writing and kind of general web presence, people come to us. But when I started doing podcast interviews and talking about what we do and some of our learnings on Twitter and stuff, I realized that we had this big influx of deals that came to us. And so we've just continued to talk about what we're doing and be more and more open.
When I'm really interested in your perspective on service-based businesses, there has been such a, you know, so much written about and so many people looking for, everyone's talking about recurring revenue and, you know, we obviously in Canada have, you know, Constellation Software, aggregating vertical software companies. The you know, how do you compare a service-based tech business with a recurring revenue business? There's so many people that say, you know, we don't touch the services side, it's too hard. But I mean, you built a great business in the space and you continue to invest in the space and do well.
So I think if you talk to any investor, they would be over the moon to own Visa or MasterCard, right? A business with an incredible moat and a network effect. But they'd also be happy if they didn't have a lot of other options or if they could buy it at a fair price to buy Four Seasons hotels. But if you think about it, you know, Four Seasons is a really exceptional business, and it's mostly because of its brand and its reputation. And as long as it continues to maintain that brand and reputation, travelers are going to continue to go and spend $2,000 a night to go to Hawaii and stay in the Four Seasons there. And I think that services businesses are similar. If you own a great one, it's a great business. If you own a bad one that doesn't have a brand, it's not a great business. So, you know, if you own a motel, some random motel, the Dolphin Motel off of, you know, Route 66, not a great business. If you own the Four Seasons, it's phenomenal. And so with our services businesses, I mean, we didn't really get this when we started, but with MetaLab, we've been able to build a global brand that is has total association with this kind of startup boom and some of the top companies in the world, and really doing cutting edge design. And so we look at it and go, this is a great business as long as we can continue to do great work and maintain that. But if I was offered Visa, I'd always rather buy Visa, right? It's the problem with the services business is that at the end of the day, it's still reliant on people. It still scales linearly. So I always think that a services-based business is a great launch pad business. It's a great place to start. It can be a great place to invest, but it's not the perfect business, which is kind of what drove us to start diversifying and building SaaS businesses, getting into the Shopify space and acquiring other companies over time.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I've listened to a few of your podcasts and you talk about kind of your evolution as a value investor. What caused that transition to occur?
Well, I think that, you know, if you're a good operator, you know what a good business looks like and a bad business looks like. I was a member of EO, Entrepreneurs Organization, for a very long time. And through that, I would get insights into all sorts of other people's businesses. And, you know, over time, I realized that I had an exceptional business, that my business was much less competitive, that we had pricing power, that we had high margins, you know, that we could run virtually, we could access global markets, et cetera. You know, I was in groups at EO where I was learning about, you know, woodworking businesses, puzzle companies, mapping software companies, you know, all sorts of different businesses. And as I started looking at those businesses, hearing the owner's stories, and eventually looking at P&Ls, I realized I had an exceptional business. And so, you know, once you understand the operational challenges of those businesses, you're naturally a value investor. You know, you just have that, you have that sense. You have an immediate sense of how hard would it be if I just waved a magic wand and I was the CEO of this business to operate day to day. And so we really like to buy businesses where, you know, I would be comfortable having, I would feel that if I worked, you know, moderately hard, I could have an amazing outcome in this business and that I wouldn't have to blow my brains out running it. Because, you know, when you have a great business with a great model in a growing space with not too much competition, you don't really have to be a genius to do well. So we really kind of focus there. And while it's exciting to learn about cryptocurrency and AI and, you know, all these cutting edge technologies, that's just not a space that we want to play in, because you couldn't pay me enough money to be the CEO of any of those companies because it's just so cutthroat.
So you mentioned the Shopify network, which kind of brings me to, you're the chair of WeCommerce. Disclosure, it's one of the top five holdings in our small cap fund. Maybe elaborate a little bit on the Shopify ecosystem and how you guys participate there.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a funny story. Back in 2010, I was at a tech conference and I met this guy named Harley Finkelstein. And at the time, he was kind of running biz dev at Shopify. Shopify was maybe 15 or 20 people, and they were about to raise their Series A. I'd heard of Shopify. I kind of admired their design and thought they had a great platform. I'd played with it a little bit. And he said, look, I love the work you guys do at MetaLab. I'd love for you guys to bring your design skills to our platform and create some templates. And at the time, when you opened a Shopify store, you had a blank slate. There was a default theme. There was only one, I believe, at the time. And it just didn't look that great. And so in order for you to have a beautiful store, you actually had to understand how to do HTML and CSS and customize something. And so basically, we became their first partner doing themes for their theme marketplace. And we thought of it as a kind of a side business, something that we would do as almost a favor to them. And, you know, we thought they were cool guys and wanted an excuse to work with them. But it ended up turning into a phenomenal, really high margin business where effectively we could build a theme once and then we could sell it for years and years and years, kind of like software. And our only cost was support. And so that business continued to do really, really well. But in around 2014, I was completely overwhelmed. So I'd started my agency in 2006. For the subsequent years, I'd started a variety of other businesses, incubated with all my own money within MetaLab. And by 2013, I was running four or five businesses. And I was absolutely hating my life. I was totally overwhelmed. And so a friend of mine said, dude, you need to, calm down and, sell one of your businesses and take some of the heat off. And Pixel Union was the easiest one to sell. And so I ended up selling it to a family office and I kept 20% and stayed on the board. And what ended up happening is I got this big pile of money from the sale and I said, okay, well, I've been operating all these businesses for a long time. I really need to learn how stocks and bonds and real estate work. Maybe I should go build a passive portfolio for retirement. And I just got really lucky. One of the first books my friend recommended to me was The Making of an American Capitalist, the biography of Warren Buffett. And I'd always thought of Buffett as some kind of quant investor. I didn't think of him as a business person. And as I read, I realized how incredibly entrepreneurial he was and what a great executive and leader he was. And I was just blown away by the structure of Berkshire Hathaway. And then also by this concept of moats. And I think I intrinsically understood moats because I was an operator and I knew friends with more difficult businesses. But as I read, I went, oh my God, I just sold a business with a moat. Here I was with Shopify, which was a whale that was growing and growing and growing and was going to own, a percent of e-commerce over time and be this huge player. And I had one of the dominant businesses in the space and I'd made a mistake. And so, I still own part of the business. I was still happy to do that. And I worked really hard on recruiting a great CEO to run it and was an active board member, helped do some M&A and stuff. But what ended up happening was in 2019, we got the sense that the majority shareholder would be willing to sell it to us. And so we ended up making a bid. And at the time, I had met Bill Ackman and Andrew Marks and Ryan Graves, who's the co-founder of Uber, and Shane Parrish from Farnham Street, a few interesting friends. And each of them had independently said, hey, if you ever have a good deal, let's invest together. And I knew this business, so I was really confident about it. And I was incredibly bullish. And so what we did is we bought 50% of the business ourselves, and then 50% went to our partners. And we injected $25 million for M&A. And so we ended up going out and starting to acquire as many phenomenal businesses as we could because we were so bullish about the future of Shopify. And we called this holding company WeCommerce. And we made some great acquisitions. And then about, 2 months ago, we took the business public on the TSX Ventures just to get additional access to capital. And it's going really well. We've been really enjoying having a public company. That's never something we've done before.
How, having been public for a couple months now, you guys settling into things, how's the M&A pipeline coming along? in what you're allowed to disclose?
Well, I can just say that we've had a, you know, healthy amount of interest, and that being public has really helped us be taken seriously. You know, before people would kind of say, you know, they don't know how big we are, and Tiny's been kind of quiet, so they didn't know what our ability to cut checks are. And now, you know, on any given day, the market cap is, you know, in the high hundreds of millions. I think last I checked, 900 million or something like that. So suddenly people are going, oh, wow, these guys can cut a big check and do large deals. And so we've had a lot of interest. I can't talk about anything, but we've had a, you know, interesting pipeline of opportunities, and we may not do anything for a year. We might, you know, close something, no way to know. But we're really excited about it. And it's been cool to have so many different tools in the capital allocation toolkit to play with. That's something that's new to us, having, you know, a public currency and stuff.
Yeah. One thing I found really interesting about WeCommerce, I mean, we love Shopify, and I mean, I totally agree with your bullish view on the Shopify ecosystem. Where I think some people would see risk, though, would be, you know, being part of that partner ecosystem and being reliant on Shopify. And kind of the way we looked at it is we've got a long history with partners who work in the Salesforce ecosystem, and Salesforce has created this wonderful ecosystem, and we kind of saw that as certainly risk mitigating for you guys. How do you view the risk associated with the Shopify ecosystem, and did you look at Salesforce? And interested in your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. I mean, we looked at Salesforce, we looked at Apple. You know, at the end of the day, they want a healthy platform ecosystem. And when their partners do well, that means Shopify is doing well. And Shopify ultimately is one of the largest beneficiaries of what we do, because it brings more merchants to the platform and it locks them in and it increases the extensibility of Shopify. You know, we also have known Harley and Toby for 10 plus years, and there's a high level of trust. They've been exceptional partners to us. So, you know, we don't think too much about that. And I think it's no different than somebody investing in a business that has a variety of apps in the iOS App Store. I think as long as you don't step on Apple's toes and try and create you know, kind of core functionality that they want to own themselves, you don't have a problem. And I think the same is true with Shopify. You know, we would never build a cart and checkout app, right? We know that Shopify is really going to care about that. Where we'll focus is in areas where Shopify wants the ecosystem to help them achieve things they couldn't otherwise do.
So you're embarking on, you acquired a few companies in that space. You've acquired a lot of companies through Tiny. And I mean, I love talking and meeting with entrepreneurs and people who've built companies. What are some of the key takeaways or lessons, things you've learned from the CEOs of the companies you've acquired over the years?
Well, yeah, typically what we do is we find founders where they want to sail off into the sunset. Sometimes they want to stay involved as an advisor, or maybe they want to focus on R&D or something like that, but usually they're leaving. And so when they leave, we're often hiring a new CEO. And I mean, what we've found is that we just want to hire people who have done it before. You know, it's interesting, like if you're building a house, you're not going to go to the kid down the street and say, hey, I see you like doing carpentry and woodworking. Can you, you know, rebuild my kitchen? You're going to go to the expert who's done it 100 times. And so what we've learned is that we should never hire someone for potential or because we like them or they're our friend or something like that, that we should instead focus on the expert craftsman who's, you know, scaled 10 businesses of this size and is really comfortable with a P&L and a team of this scale, and knows how to get to 3 to 5 times bigger. And we've seen that as long as we compensate them in a way where they're hyper aligned with us and all the incentives line up, that really, really good things happen when you do that. You know, you look at what Bill Ackman did with Canadian Pacific. He went out and he found Hunter Harrison. Hunter Harrison had turned around multiple railways. You plug in Hunter Harrison, you let him do his thing, and you have a great return. And so I'd say we kind of follow that same playbook in our little corner of the internet.
You talked a lot about Buffett and Munger, but also yourself being an extreme delegator. What are some of the frameworks you use for incentives, and what's worked and what hasn't?
Well, it's interesting. One great example is we bought a business. We felt that we might want to sell it in the future. This is kind of before we'd kind of settled on the fact we'd just hold everything forever. We kind of felt like it might be something we would sell. And it was high revenue, low margin, and we wanted the CEO to continue to invest in growth. And the CEO was hyper incentivized for the long term. And so what we did is we gave the CEO an options package where he could acquire, I believe it was 7% of the business at the valuation that Tiny paid for it. And so we thought we would be hyper aligned by doing that. And what we realized was that as the business had free cash flow and was stacking up cash, he would always, every quarter, he'd have a plan for it. So he'd say, oh, you know, guys, I know there's $5 million sitting in the bank this quarter in working capital, but, you know, we got a big growth initiative next quarter. And then the next quarter, there'd be $7 million sitting in the bank. And he'd say, guys, I know there's $7 million, but I think we've got this big project coming. And so we realized that he actually had no incentive to dividend cash out because he wasn't participating in it. And so what we did, we finally realized this. We were having this tug of war every quarter, and our CFO is rolling up her sleeves and arguing with him and stuff. And finally, we just changed it. We said, well, you know, he's effectively a shareholder. Let's just give him a dividend. Whenever we dividend out the cash, we'll give him pro rata as a bonus. And as soon as we did that, the behavior completely changed, and he was very, very keen on doing dividends. So incentives ultimately do drive behavior. And it's always difficult to figure out exactly, based on someone's personality, how they're going to react to different incentives. And sometimes you have to shift them around. But they're incredibly powerful, you know, way more powerful than any coaching or anything else we've found.
Well, incentives are more powerful than coaching.
I think so. I mean, I've been shocked by, if you incentivize someone to figure something out, you know, let's say you incentivize free cash flow, they're going to suddenly dig into everything and learn what they need to learn to achieve that. You know, one big learning from us is it has to be something that's accessible. So they need to hit it the first time they try to. Otherwise, they get kind of dismayed and feel like it's out of reach. The other thing we've messed up in the past is doing compensation or bonus arrangements that are based on a budget. And what happens with that is that, you know, we might say, okay, the business did $10 million of EBITDA this year, and it's been growing at 20% annualized. So we expect the budget to be $12 million of earnings for next year. And time again, the management team would say, oh, I know we've had 10 solid years of 20% growth, but this year everything's changing and it's a brutal year and we're going to be lucky to get 3%. And then we'd have a tug of war and we'd negotiate it to 5%. And lo and behold, they would always hit 20%. And so we have now removed all budgeting from all the companies. We're stripping that out, and we're just setting a hurdle where we say, look, you know, the business has been growing historically at this organic rate. Anything in excess of this, and you trigger your bonus. And the more you exceed it, the more you make in bonus or stock grants. And that's worked very, very well when we've done it. And then, you know, obviously there's an adjustment if we have a difficult year or, you know, COVID hits or something. We sometimes will readjust the benchmark.
Yeah. So you're basically looking at intrinsic value growth and comping on that.
Exactly. Exactly.
One thing I think a couple people would love to hear about is you had lunch with Bill Ackman a couple of years ago.
It was a funny story. So I do some stock market investing just in my personal account. And, you know, I'm kind of a value nerd, and I've spent tons of time reading about all the big names in value investing. And Bill was someone I'd followed for a long time. And I always just found him so fascinating. Like, he was so earnest, and, you know, the Herbalife battle and, you know, everything that he did, I just kind of went like, wow, this guy's like super, super interesting. Very dissimilar to some of the other folks. Basically his life kind of fell apart in, I don't know what it was, 2015, where he had the Herbalife debacle, and, you know, that investment went against him, and then Valiant went against him, And then, you know, he went through a difficult divorce and everyone was redeeming out of his fund and lost a whole bunch of AUM. And what I noticed was that he had a public closed-end fund and it had a portfolio of securities and that he'd really cleaned up his portfolio. It didn't have Valiant anymore. It was full of stuff like Lowe's and Chipotle and Nike and Starbucks. So it was very blue chip and it was trading at a almost a 40% discount to net asset value. And so I went, wow, like, I don't care what you think about Bill. If you've got a portfolio of blue chip stocks that you can buy at a 40% discount, this seems amazing. And so I loaded up. It was my largest single position. And I, around that time, was browsing a newsletter and it said that Bill Ackman was doing a charity lunch. And so I went and I said, you know what? I'm going to bid on this charity lunch. And if I like him, I'll keep my stock. And if I think he's an asshole, then I'll sell my stock. And so it's kind of diligence. And then it's also just a fun story to get to go have lunch with Bill Ackman. And so Chris and I, my business partner, Chris and I flew to New York and show up at this seafood restaurant. And Bill shows up and he's like 6'5 or 6'6. He's huge. He's taller than I am. I'm 6'3. And he was just incredibly warm and engaging and funny. And we ended up talking for like 5 or 6 hours about, you know, everything we were doing and everything he'd been through in his crazy career. And we just had a great time. And at the end of the lunch, he said, look, I really like you guys. I don't know if you know this, but I actually do some tech investing off the side of my desk through my family office. And if you guys ever have a deal, you know, I'd love to do something together. And so, you know, Bill and I just kept in touch. We do phone calls occasionally and we shared different venture deals and stuff. And then, you know, when the time came with WeCommerce, we said, you know, you'd be the perfect partner for us. And Bill has been absolutely incredible, you know, a really great mentor. He's saved us massive amounts of money on in all sorts of, you know, very dumb decisions we would have otherwise made. It's just incredible to be able to call someone who's had such a wide variety of investing experiences.
Yeah. Is there one piece of advice that resonates with you that you'd be willing to share today?
I mean, I've said it a couple times on other interviews, but the thing that's always stuck with me is just this idea of thinking in decades. You know, when we went, when we had lunch with him, we kind of said, you know, we have a variety of different, you know, low quality businesses, high quality businesses. Should we sell them? And, you know, his approach was really just think in decades. Don't worry about selling anything. Just keep compounding and doing what you're doing. And it kind of calmed us down, you know, and when we got to have, we also got to have dinner with Charlie Munger and he said the exact same thing. It's like, make a good decision once every 5 to 10 years. And when you think like that, it's amazing. Your heart rate really comes down and you feel a lot calmer. So in general, my goal is to make, you know, maybe one good decision a year and the rest of them will kind of take care of themselves. So that's been a big, big lesson that's been driven home by a few people.
Yeah, that, I mean, that is, it's such an interesting lesson as when you're younger in your career and, you know, a bit more impatient, it's a harder lesson to incorporate in your day to day.
Totally. And I'm very impatient and I love forward momentum. I love getting hopped up on deals. And so I've had to distract myself. I have to have a little hobby businesses or things to keep me busy so that I don't get my hands on the tools and try and, you know, go put something together. So it's been very effective. Pabrai, Monish Pabrai talks about having everyone, every good investor should play bridge for 2 or 3 hours and have a nap and have a long lunch with a friend. And I kind of agree with that. You need to distract yourself in order to make good decisions.
One thing I find fascinating, I mean, I love following you on Twitter because you're always trying new ideas and ways of doing things just out loud. So you've gone calendarless. How's that working out so far? Because it's something I've toyed with and I just don't know if I could do it.
Shockingly good. I mean, the problem that I've had is, you know, I'll wake up in the morning, I'll get to the office, I'll start digging into a problem that's very pressing, where it's the most important thing I could possibly be doing, or it's just requires deep thinking. And then halfway through it, I would get a calendar alert and it would say, you need to get on the phone with someone. And I'm an extrovert. I like talking to people. I'm perfectly happy to do that. And I like being busy. But what I don't like is artificially having all these time constraints in my day. And I just found that, you know, there's something about when you know you have, you know, even if you have a 2-hour gap, if you know you have something coming up performative in 2 hours, you just don't feel that your day is free and you can really focus. And so for a long time, I've been complaining about this and trying different things, you know, doing one meeting a day or 2 meetings a day or structuring things. And I actually, I got inspired by Mark Leonard from Constellation. What he does is you email him and say, Mark, I need to talk to you. And he says, great. Or his, you know, assistant says, great. Mark's available in 2 weeks on this day. Email me the day before and I'll give you his number and then you can try him. And he said, what ends up happening is a lot of the time people don't even end up following up with the email and they solve their own problem. If they do follow up, then his assistant gives the number and says, if he doesn't pick up, just text him, or he'll pick up if he's available, but, you know, try him back or whatever. And so I just thought that was brilliant. And I started doing that. So now what I do is basically we'll say, okay, call me on the 14th. Here's my number. And I note on my calendar to expect a call from this person. And then if I don't pick up, I just say, text me and I'll call you back when I get a moment. And so what it's meant is that I still do the same number of calls in the day, but they're done when I'm in the car or I'm, you know, heading home or just at a time where I feel focused and ready to do a call. And it's worked surprisingly well. I think there's a few people occasionally who will go, man, this guy's an asshole because I don't follow the rules of calendars, right? I think a lot of people are expecting to have a set time. And obviously I'll make exceptions if it's someone, you know, really intense. I'll do a scheduled time. But it's worked really well so far. I'm a month in.
You brought up Mark Leonard's name, you know, who's just, you know, built one of the best software companies in the world. And he was so off the radar for a long time, even in Canada, building a Canadian company. But it's just this great model of capital allocation in the software space. I mean, how much do you guys look to Mark and Constellation in what you do?
We've followed them from a distance for a long time, and I've read all their letters, and I love the way they think. They're much more focused than we are on a very specific vertical. I would say we're much more akin to Berkshire, where we kind of say we expand our circle of competence over time, and there's a wide variety of businesses that we can understand, whereas they've been maniacally focused on recurring revenue businesses, specifically software, and then, you know, hyper-verticalizing and growing via acquisition. That's not really something we've focused on. So I'd say our models are very different, but we've learned so much about incentives and reporting and kind of metrics to track and how they think about capital allocation. And my business partner, Chris, has gotten the chance to speak with Mark, which is where I got the calendar anecdote. And so it's been really cool. We've spoken to quite a few of their board members about incentives and how they do it. And I think they probably have the best incentive structure in corporate, you know, North America. I think I absolutely love how they think about it.
And then also, like, the you know, saying you're more like Berkshire. I mean, one of the great things about Berkshire is how decentralized they are and the autonomy that Buffett gives the CEOs to run all the companies. I mean, how do you juggle that? I mean, because obviously if you're buying companies with basically product or tech people running it, and you know, you see low-hanging fruit to increase value in the company, how do you find the balance between, you know, being helpful and staying out of the way?
Typically, when we acquire a business, in the process of kind of digging into it, we identify what we call a bird in the hand and two in the bush. And so bird in the hand might be something very, very simple. It could be a simple insight like, you know, everyone else in this industry is charging $299 for this software, and we're charging $199 a year. When we buy it, let's increase the price to $199, or let's change the way we do recurring, or let's sell this ad inventory, or just something very simple where we basically go, there's a 95% chance that we can do this and we can make the change within 2 months of owning it. And so those are the things we base our assumptions off of when we buy a business. Those are the things I'm willing to build into the model. What I'm not willing to build into the model is future opportunities, of which we think there's tons. So we would say, okay, there's two in the bush. There's, you know, we could add another product line. We could expand into another space. We could change the model. We could do M&A. I'm just never going to make those assumptions in our model. And so typically when we hire a CEO, we'll sit them down and we'll say, look, here's the business. Here's what it's done historically. Here's our bird in the hand opportunities. All we care about is you executing on these, and they're very simple. These are not difficult tasks. They're not boulders to push up a hill. So do those. And then here's a bunch of ideas. Here's the two in the bush. These are all the ideas we have. But you know, you're smart. You'll figure it out. You don't have to listen to us. You do whatever you want with these. And then we kind of say, you know, jump in the pool and good luck learning how to swim and go. And all we require from our CEOs is monthly financials, which their CFO can send. They don't have to add any color commentary. And then a quarterly SWOT analysis, which is literally an email. And we may not respond to the email unless there's a request for us to respond to something. And if at any time they want our feedback or approval on something, they can always call us and we'll always pick up the phone within, 10 minutes. So typically the only way we engage with the CEOs is brainstorming on a difficult challenge that they're having, which occasionally happens, approving big R&D expenditures or marketing expenditures or something that are way outside of their kind of typical budget, and then M&A. And often, the companies will look at a bolt-on M&A or something opportunity.
WeCommerce, you're obviously looking to acquire companies in the Shopify ecosystem. We've co-invested in a couple of companies, one in Vancouver Island in particular. And just kind of to give me a feel, we see a lot on the tech side. Do you have a sweet spot for tiny that you're looking for right now?
We bias to larger businesses, but the larger businesses are not always available at fair prices right now. And so we sometimes will buy small stuff that we think has an opportunity to 10 or 20x, and we have a long history of doing that. So we call those base hits. We'll still do base hits. We'll still do cigar butts where we can buy, maybe there's a distressed startup that has a spin out business or something that we can acquire very cheaply. But it goes back to, if I can buy Visa, I'd way rather buy that than a motel. Maybe I can buy the motel for 2.5 times earnings and, Visa is 20 times. I still want to buy Visa if I can. But if Visa isn't available, sure, I'll buy the motel for 2.5 times earnings and still make a nice cash flow yield.
So we've talked a lot about what you've invested in, what you like to invest in. Would you be willing to share what your biggest missed investment was?
One that we looked at that I really was kicking myself about, and I still don't know, I think we messed up on, was we looked at meetup.com, and it was in the heart of COVID. And you can't imagine a more impacted business than meetup.com, right? Nobody's meeting up at all right now, let alone in March when COVID was breaking out. And it was quite an interesting opportunity. WeWork had acquired it for like $250 million. And WeWork was distressed. They were selling off all their assets. And we made a bid on it, but we didn't have high enough conviction. We were too concerned. I don't believe it's an error. I think we made the right decision based on the information we had at the time. But in our model, we saw a potential opportunity where we could have made our money back in 2 years. But on the downside scenario, if COVID had gone on longer than it has, or if the vaccine hadn't come along, we felt we could lose a ton of money. So there's things like that where I look at them and I think we made the right decision, but I do kick myself. I do go, man, that's a great business. I wish we could own it. But given the information we had at the time, I think we probably made the right decision. And the jury is still out. And there's lots of stuff like that. I think everyone has a great anti-portfolio of all the things they missed. But I just try and focus on, the base hits and stuff that's pretty obvious to me versus the stuff with significant downside and high upside. We always like to do the strategy of, if we lose, we lose a little. And if we win big.
The kind of, before we wrap things up, how did you and Chris meet? When did you first start working together?
It's a really funny story. So, previously in the interview, I talked about, working with people who have done it before and not just, randomly hiring friends and stuff. Well, Chris and I met by me walking into the TD Bank locally and getting a credit card. I was getting a credit card or a credit line or something. And Chris was sitting behind the desk and we ended up hitting it off and having a great conversation. And I was just kind of chatting with him socially as we filled out this form. And I said, well, you know, what's your story? You seem interesting. And he says, well, my girlfriend is a lawyer and we just moved to Victoria so she'd go to law school. And I'm getting my accounting designation. I'm trying to figure out what to do. And this is in 2009, 2010. I was very financially unsophisticated. At the time, I would just look at the bank balance on the first of the month and then the 30th of the month. And as long as we had more money in the bank on the 30th, I knew we were golden. But I started to realize I had a weak spot with finance and I didn't understand accounting. And so I needed someone to come in and own that. And so I just blurted out to Chris, I said, do you want to be my CFO? And he went, oh, wow, that's interesting. And we ended up meeting a few times after that and having coffee. And it was good, you know, just great vibes and really hit it off. And he ended up coming in and he was incredible. I think, you know, I got insanely lucky with that hire. I wouldn't recommend, you know, that hiring strategy. But Chris was just always in the trenches with me. He helped me realize, you know, how to think about a P&L and the path of a dollar and margins and kind of showed me the language of business and how to think about all the various companies. And I was always the gas. I was always yes. And Chris was always the break. He was no. And so he was a great counterbalance to me. And as we scaled, there were very few people who had a sense of ownership that really cared and, you know, cared as much as I did. And Chris always just cared as much as I did, even before he was an equity shareholder. And so it became very logical to me that we should be business partners. And when, you know, I made him or he invested in some of the businesses and then had some stock options. And then when we started Tiny, we co-invested and we said, you know, let's do this together. So now we own it together and we make all of our decisions together. And it's been incredible. He's like a, you know, brother and a best friend. And it's been a wonderful partnership.
That's a great story. Like, and TD's probably going to pick up on this and like use it in their marketing materials to get university students working.
Right. The branches for them. Yeah, exactly. So my advice to everybody is just go to the local TD and go to the bank teller and then make them your CFO and things will do well. You'll build a $1 billion business.
So Andrew, thanks so much for this. The selfish part of this is I'm always looking for a great new book to read. Is there anything you've read recently that you could recommend today?
I read a really great book. So I love reading business and stuff, but I love like escapism when I'm getting stressed out or something. And I read a really good book a couple months ago called Enemy of All Mankind by Stephen Berlin Johnson. And it's about pirates. It's about a specific pirate, a British pirate. I can't believe like, you know, only 250, 300 years ago, all, you know, you'd have like 200 men on this tiny little boat with scurvy traveling around the Caribbean and, you know, just how different our lives are now. So I love Stephen Johnson's writing and that book was really great. I really enjoyed it.
That sounds very interesting.
The other one that I reread recently is a more of a business book, but it's called How to Get Rich and it has a horrible title. Very ostentatious, but it's written by this guy, Felix Dennis, who was a magazine publisher, kind of magazine magnate, and made hundreds of millions of dollars and then regretted it, became a crackhead and wasted $100 million on drugs and women and all sorts of other stuff, lived this crazy life, and then became a poet in the 2000s. And then he wrote this book, which is kind of a it is a manual on, you know, how to run businesses and how to operate and how to grow and how to ultimately get rich. But it's actually a very interesting argument for why you don't want to get rich. And he's just a fascinating character and a great writer. So I just finished that one. And I read that for the second time and it's amazing.
That it's so funny. A title like that can turn people off. Like,
totally. I always give the disclaimer. It's a horrible title and I hate recommending it for that reason, but it's a wonderful, really, really well-written book with a great message.
Well, two great recommendations. We can learn how to get rich and we can also learn how to avoid pirates and scurvy. So thanks for that, Andrew. Thank you, listeners. You can find more resources on our website at penderfund.com. We'll be back in the virtual podcast studio again soon. In the meantime, stay well. Until next time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Dave.
Thanks, Andrew.
Penda is an independent, employee-owned investment firm located in Vancouver, British Columbia. Our goal is to protect and grow wealth for our investors over time. To achieve this, we seek to understand the quality of a business or security, obtain more value than we are paying for, deploy capital in flexible mandates, and mitigate downside risk. We have a talented investment team of expert analysts, security selectors, and independent thinkers. They manage a suite of niche investment funds with active, concentrated portfolios of value-based, occasionally contrarian investments. We invest in our funds too. You can learn more at pendafund.com.